it's really good having you here. I wanted to talk to you for a long time. As I was reading Daughters, I came across a paragraph in which Ursa talks about her previous apartment in Park West Village, 14th floor, with a terrace and a southern view. Mm-hmm. Is that not true?
Yes, that's right.
It just so happens I have an apartment in Park West Village,
oh my.
14th floor, with a terrace and a southern view.
Oh, my. You're not going to give it up, though, as he did hers, huh?
No, I can't. I couldn't afford to give it up. I've been there for 20 years.
But, oh, I see.
It was my neighborhood, so that's one of the reasons I kept on going. I said, hey, this is my part of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, tell me, I wanted to ask you not only some things about yourself, but, of course, how Daughters came about. But let's start with you first, because I know you've been around for a long time as a writer. You've put in your dues.
Oh, that's right. And I had sort of committed myself when I started out to stay the course, not to be put off or disheartened or dismayed by all of the things that one has to kind of deal with, confront as a writer, not only in terms of the work, but also in terms of the publishing business itself. But that I had committed myself to being a writer of fiction, and that's what I was going to do with pretty much the rest of my life. I think that having made that decision early on made it possible for me to kind of ride the tide of all of the ups and downs that kind of are sort of inevitable when you are a writer of fiction.
When I graduated from college, I went to journalism school. I called my father. I had my first job. It was working the midnight shift at a television and radio station in Huntington, West Virginia, and I was so happy I had this job, and I was telling him how I was able to work the overnight shift. I went in at midnight, and my father, who was a longtime businessman, said, well, there's something unnatural about that. Well, in a way, there's something unnatural about being a writer. It's very difficult. It's very difficult work in an unusual field for people to go into. Well, there's something unnatural about that.
Yes, well, it seems to me the most natural thing in the world, even though I agree with you that in sort of the ordinary perception, the perception of, say, lay people and so on, people who don't write, that it's an odd thing for anybody to want to do. I think that it was put very nicely some years ago by one of our great short story writers, Flannery O'Connor, who said, writing a novel is a burden and a pain. It makes the hair fall out and the teeth decay, which is why I write short stories, to get the agony over with faster. And I mean, there's something very peculiar about the novelist, especially, who can really stay with a piece of fiction for a long period of time. And I'm one who tends to stay with it for a particularly long period of time. It's just the way you are. It's just doing the thing that feels natural to you and comfortable for you. It's your way of also communicating with the world.
But it must take an enormous amount of discipline. Most of us come to work. We have to be here at a specific time, and we leave at a specific time. We get a paycheck every Thursday, but no one stands behind you and says, Paul, I have a gun at your head. Get busy at that typewriter.
That's true. That's true. And I have to remind myself sometimes when I, do experience the occasional question is, why am I doing this?
You're asking yourself.
Of course, yes. And I do say, nobody put a gun to your head and said you had to do it. You made the choice yourself. And once I made that choice, I was totally committed to it. Because, you see, the thing is, I didn't come to writing fiction just immediately after college. I worked for a time. And so I sort of knew what it was like out there in the marketplace, so to speak. And I knew I didn't feel particularly comfortable doing that. And that what I'd been avoiding by being in the marketplace was really, in a sense, doing the thing I wanted to do, which was writing fiction. And so once I went through all of that questioning period, I was able to then make a decision that was one I could really give myself to totally. And so, as I said before, when I started writing, I knew that was the thing I was going to do for pretty much the rest of my life.
Well, writing is something that maybe some people don't realize. It is art. And there is within almost all of us some form of creative urge, whether it's refinishing furniture in the basement or sculpting or knitting. I mean, these are all creative urges. And writing is really probably at the top, but it's also perhaps the most complex.
Well, it doesn't seem complex to me because I came by it very naturally. I grew up among a group of women, about 5 or 6 women, including my mother, who were consummate storytellers. They were immigrant women from a tiny little island in the West Indies called Barbados. And they had come here to this country as young girls and didn't have any particular skills, so that the only kind of work they could get was as domestics, working in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. And what they would do, those women, would be to, once they came home from their jobs, they had maybe about once or twice a week, they would gather in the kitchen of the brownstone house where I lived on Hancock Street. And they would sit around, I remember, this large oilcloth covered table in the middle of this large kitchen, and they would talk. They wouldn't just gossip. I mean, they did some gossiping. But they talked about everything under the sun, and they had an opinion about everything. They also told marvelous stories. And I was, for many years, as a little girl, sort of locked into the kitchen with those women, because as a girl child, as they referred to me, I wasn't permitted to run up and down the streets the way a boy would be. And that was a period when children were to be seen but not heard. And so all I could do was to sit there with them in the kitchen listening to these stories and waiting upon them, because I would have to keep them supplied with cocoa and tea and so on. And of course I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be outside playing with my friends. But of course that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I suspect that it was there that I absorbed that whole love of storytelling. I remember wanting, not in a very sort of conscious way, but wanting to have something of their power with words, their ability to create in this kind of casual, extemporaneous way, just casually sitting around the table, telling these marvelous stories, not ever thinking of writing them down, because they knew perhaps that next day they would create stories that were even better. And for me, I was just amazed at that, amazed at it. And as I said, wanting to see if someday I might not be able to do the same kinds of magical and marvelous things with words. So I think it all began very early on for me. Not that I actually engaged the whole art of writing immediately in my teens or anything. It took me until into my 20s before I was brave enough to commit myself to paper. But I think that early on there, those early years, was where it all began for me. So it seemed perfectly natural when I finally made the decision that that's what I was going to do with my life.
Well, your first book,
Brown Girl, Brown Stones.
Brown Girl, Brown Stones. How did that come about?
Well, I was in the marketplace.
That's still in print, I understand.
Yes, yeah. Still in print, and it's become the most amazing thing. It's become a kind of modern classic, and it's a very sort of gratifying experience for me because, well, you know, a writer has to be dead at least 100 years before a book becomes a classic. Anyway, it is taught all over the place, and each generation of young women come to that novel. I'm talking about a very diverse group of women, come to that novel and find that they can empathize and sympathize and become involved with not only the young woman who's the protagonist, but the story in general. So that's been a very gratifying experience for me. But how did I come to write Brown Girl, Brown Stones? Well, I was in the marketplace. I was working for this magazine. I had started out as a researcher, running around getting the material for the writers. And then because it was a magazine in serious financial trouble.
Which magazine was it?
It was called Our World Magazine, and it was the only serious competition to Ebony Magazine back in the 50s. And because they were having problems financially, I was very quickly promoted to a feature writer. I was just out of college. And I spent my day slogging out these stories that had to do with the usual kind of thing in Ebony, entertainers, black entertainers. How many hundreds of pairs of shoes do they have in their closets? How many swimming pools in the backyard? That kind of thing. And I became fearful that I was going to spend the rest of my life being a kind of hack writer for a second or third rate magazine. And in sheer desperation one night, I went home and started writing Brown Girl, Brown Stones. And it took me 5 years to write the novel because I was learning how to write, first of all, pretty much on my own, but also I was still working on this job, you know, cranking out the stuff about black entertainers. But even though it was kind of demanding and rigorous, I could do it. First of all, I was young and had that tremendous kind of energy. The other thing was that the novel had been waiting there for the longest time for me to write it. And so, in a sense, it was in many ways the easiest of the books for me to write. Not that it didn't present me with all kinds of problems, but in the sense that so much of it had been there kind of taking shape and form at a deeper level, so that when I came to actually write it, so much of it was already in place.
Well, here you are, a young woman with a first novel. What did you do with it?
Well, there I was with this over 600 pages of manuscript sitting on my desk, and I had done it all alone because at that point, there was no support system. I mean, there was no sort of flowering of black women writers. There was no community of writers for me to go to. You really had to be very self-impelled. You had to really want to do it that badly. And so there it was, sitting on my desk, all of those manuscript pages, and I didn't know a thing about the publishing business, how to go about it. So I didn't know that one has to get an agent, and the agent will then sort of run interference for you and knows the publishing houses to circulate the book to. Didn't know any of that. So I simply went to the yellow pages of the New York telephone book, publishers, and started out with the B's, Bob's Merrill. Sent it off, wrapped it up, nice brown package, and sent it off to Bob's Merrill. And most extraordinary luck. Even though they didn't publish it, but it was lucky anyway, it came across the desk of an editor, Buckland Moon, I think it was, Buckland Moon, who instead of just sending back this cold manuscript, as they do, decided to look at the first couple of pages and became taken with it, wrote me saying that he liked it and he would see what he could do with it there at Bob's Merrill. But like so many editors, he was having his problems, you know, musical chairs and editors. And he found himself released from Bob's Merrill, and they sent my manuscript back to me. Well, that took a period of about 8 months or so while all that was going on. I was sitting there waiting for some final word about my book. Well, it came back to me after the 8 months, and Buckland Moon was gone from Bob's Merrill. I had my manuscript back in hand. In the meantime, I had heard that there was an editor at Random House who was very sympathetic to young writers, that he had just published William Styron's Lie Down in Darkness, his first novel. Well, that's all I needed to hear. I certainly qualified. I was a young writer, and I needed some sympathy. And so I bundled up my manuscript again and mailed it off to Hiram Hayden, who was editor-in-chief at Random House then. And Hiram loved the book, called me in and said, look here, I'm going to try to get you some kind of a decent advance, not very much money, because, of course, you know, you're just starting out. But I want you to take this small advance and to go someplace where you can stretch the dollars. Take this bloated, overwritten manuscript of yours and extricate from it the tight, beautiful little novel that's there. That is when I learned about what writing fiction is all about. It's rewriting. Writing is rewriting, at least for me.
Boy, you don't find editors like that anymore, do you?
No more. No more. The last of the great ones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. In a sense, I had to start all over again. I had to throw out whole sections, sentences I had worked on for weeks, just had to be into the waste paper basket. And that's what I learned about what it means to write fiction.
Well, isn't it true? You tell this to your students, the sentence that is awesome and beautiful, and you've struggled with it, is often the worst one in the book.
Probably, yes, that's right.
Well, that was only the beginning, because you published several novels over the years, but also you combined it with teaching. Are you teaching creative writing?
Yes, I teach creative writing, yes.
And you're teaching in Richmond?
In Richmond, Virginia, at a large, sprawling, urban university right in the middle of Richmond. It's called Virginia Commonwealth University. And I teach in the graduate program there. I conduct two fiction workshops.
So you're combining the best of two worlds. You were able to do the solitary task of writing and combine it with actually getting out and meeting people and having the ability to exchange thoughts and ideas with people. I would assume that a writer having to work so privately sometimes needs to get out and talk to other people.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I came to teaching late, though. I've only been teaching sort of off and on for about 20 years. And originally, I was an English major in college and was determined not to teach. But, of course, life plays these games on you. One should never say, I am not going to do anything. And in many ways, I had a problem when I first started teaching with suddenly being in a kind of public forum because I'd gotten so used to working alone, to working privately, and having to, in a sense, talk about what I was doing as a writer. It took me some years to adjust to that. So teaching, even though it is in many ways rewarding for me, is also something of a problem because I find that it calls upon a lot of the same energies and concentration I need for my own work, so that I can't write when I'm teaching. And I have a kind of schedule, which is one of the reasons I'm at Virginia Commonwealth University. They were the only institution of higher learning, and I've taught at any number of them, who recognized that I was a writer and not a scholar, not a professorial type, and designed for me the kind of schedule which permits me to have most of the year out of the classroom so that I teach. I conduct my two workshops in the fall semester from early September to early December, and then I'm out of the classroom until the following September. I don't teach in the spring, but I'm paid on a yearly basis.
Well, I have talked to some people who say that Judith Rossner is one who was telling me that at one time she was working as a secretary and working on looking for Mr. Goodbar and other books, and she was offered a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
She would be office manager, and she turned it down because she didn't want to deal with other people's sicknesses and all of the administrative problems. She wanted to use the job simply to finance her writing and didn't want to carry home all the problems and burdens of work. So there is something to be said for getting a less demanding job if you wish to be a writer.
Well, this is it, yes. In fact, I sometimes suggest that to my students. I remember when I was teaching at Columbia in the Master of the Fine Arts program there, that any number of my students, when they graduated, took that to mind and became taxi drivers so that they would not be, well, first of all, they got a lot of great material, you know, driving folks around, but also they were doing something that really did not demand the particular kinds of concentration and energies that they needed for the work.
Oh, man, I think taxi driving would be the last of the bad jobs.
Oh, really?
Oh, it's so frustrating to get out there and drive. There's so much anger and hostility, and and the streets, and it's such an anxious position. Also, it's dangerous job.
Well, this was back in the 70s, I'm sure.
It was dangerous then, really, too, really. Because mm-hmm. the number of taxi drivers murdered vastly exceeds the number of police officers. Mm-hmm. If you want a safe job, join the police department. At least you're armed, you know. Taxi drivers are so vulnerable, and it's such a... Boy, I have a car, and I drive on the weekends usually, not on the weekdays. Sometimes I get home, and I'm shaking after trying to drive in this town. It's so frustrating. It must be something easier than taxi work. Washing dishes maybe would be better. I'm not sure. Well, let's talk about daughters and how this book came about, because this is a book that's set both in New York and a small country in the Caribbean, Tri-Union.
Tri-Union, yeah. Yes.
So mm-hmm. tell me about this book and how you developed it.
Well, I was in the middle of writing my last book, Praise Song for the Widow. This was back in the mid-70s. And I became sort of vaguely aware of a group of about, five or six women kind of milling about in the backstage, backstage in my mind. And I couldn't really sort of make out their faces very clearly. They were all very sort of shadowy figures back there in the rear. I knew, though, that one of them was a young woman that I had wanted to write about for the longest time. In fact, ever since I was her age in my mid-30s and had never gotten around to it, other books sort of interfered and life in general kind of got in the way. I never got to tell her story. But there she was with that group of women in the back of my mind. And there was one man in the midst of these women, again, another sort of shadowy figure. And I knew, of course, that they were characters for a book that I would have to write. Didn't know what book, didn't know what story. So that when I finished writing Praise Song for the Widow, I sort of tried out some ideas on these people who had taken up residence in my head, sort of milling around, wandering around like Pirandello's six characters in search of an author. Well, they had the author, but they were waiting for the author to come up with the right story for them. And so I tried out some ideas on them. And when I say I tried out some ideas, I mean I wrote reams and reams of pages, any number of drafts. Nothing worked. They would not really reveal themselves to me. And then one evening, about 8 years ago, I was sitting in City Center Theater on West 55th Street, waiting for the lights to dim and the curtain to go up on a performance of the Alvin Ailey Dancers. And I was sort of leafing through the playbill when I came across an epigraph to one of the dances that was going to be performed that evening. And the epigraph read, "Little girl of all the daughters, you ain't no more slave. You's a woman now." And that struck me, that quote, with all of the force of a revelation, because it suggested to me, first of all, other more contemporary forms of bondage, familial within the family, political, cultural, personal, kind of bondage of the mind and the heart. And for the first time, I had a clear sense of the story I wanted to write about those women and that one man who had been sort of there, kind of waiting for me in the wings of my mind. That the daughters, in the quote and in the title, would be those women. And they would range from a slave woman by the name of Congo Jane, all the way into the future to a little girl from down the block in Brooklyn by the name of Dee Dee. And that the little girl of all the daughters, in the quote, would be that young woman in her mid-30s that I'd been wanting to write about for so long, that she would be in one way or another related to all those women, to all those daughters. I had a configuration. I could begin. I had enough of a story to begin.
Yeah, it should be noted that the daughters, does not refer to a single family, but the focus is primarily on Ursa, I believe.
Yes, it is.
The of course the most colorful male character is Primus McKenzie. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's
Primus,
right.
Or Primus?
Yes, Primus McKenzie.
Known as the PM.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's certainly a flawed character, but all of the men in Daughters seem to be flawed to me. The mayor of Midland City, for example, in Midland City?
Midland City, right, yes.
Lowell Carruthers. Mm-hmm. There are three main characters. The mayor is not a major character, but he's in there. Dr. Roy, of course, he's a rather strong character. But the men are rather weak, and Primus McKenzie is certainly flawed. The women come off a lot better in Daughters.
Well, that's certainly your perception of it. I really don't see my characters in terms of strengths and weaknesses. I don't think of them in terms of positive and negative. I don't think of them, I certainly don't try to create them, in terms of good or bad. What I try to do as a writer is to create complex, credible, interesting people who, like so many of us, have their strengths and their shortcomings. I don't even call them weaknesses. That, for me, makes for people who are far more interesting and far closer, much closer to reality. So that I really resist the tendency to kind of categorize, to pigeonhole characters, to say this character is good, this character is evil, this character is strong, this character is weak. That, I think, is really does a kind of disservice to the characters and certainly to the writer, because you're always trying to kind of create people who are composites of any number of characteristics who are complex creations. And I see Primus McKenzie, the main character, the PM, as someone who embodies, is very much a kind of complex creation. On one hand, like so many of us, someone who started out with high ideals, principles, great principles, he was going to, in those early years, really try to bring a measure of development to his constituency when he starts out as a politician. The kinds of obstacles that he confronts over the years, the fact that the political party in power refuses to, in a sense, allow fair elections, the fact that the heavy hand of the larger powers, in this instance the United States, is always felt. With each election, the Woody Wilson comes and sits in the harbor to let them know that they dare not vote in a party that would take perhaps a more socialist point of view. So there are all of these factors outside of himself that he has to deal with. There's also those aspects of himself. He gets to the place where he so desperately wants to do something for his district, for his constituents, that he begins to, and how often this happens with so many of us, he begins to make some compromises. And this is when he becomes involved in the so-called P&D Development Board. So that I don't see him as a man who is weak or flawed, but rather someone who is complex, who, like so many of us, starts out with high ideals and is seduced from those high ideals by the very harsh realities of life.
And you indicate that as a writer you're not really being judgmental about your characters.
Oh, not at all.
You portray them with all of their flaws. And
oh, yes.
I tried to reread a year or two ago Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. It's a book that I read when I was in college, and I don't know why I admired it then. It was not a readable book. The characters were so blatantly good or bad. Mm. She left no room for redemption. her philosophy was just rammed down the reader's throat, and I put it aside. I could not read it anymore. And I've learned that in life, the people sometimes portrayed as all bad aren't all bad. They make mistakes, sometimes horrible ones, but there are often good qualities to them, so we're all developed in shades of gray. And I think that's probably the way you have portrayed your characters and daughters.
Well, certainly that's the way I tried to. And I think, again, just returning very briefly to the case of Primus McKenzie, who was that one man that I started out with in my head, his wife, as well as the main character in the novel, Ursa, his daughter, recognize that he has not completely given up on his principles, that he's been sidetracked, that he's been, in a sense, taken away from them because of his desperation, but that, as his wife puts it, there is still enough that's worthwhile about your father. So that when Ursa, the daughter, moves against him, she not only frees herself from the kind of particular domination he's exercised over her life, but she also, in a way, frees him. So that one of the things I hope is suggested by the end of the novel is that the PM will perhaps be able to return to that more principled position that he had as a young man. I don't state it. I'm not that kind of writer. I just simply suggest it.
Well, the story's not over, just like most of our lives.
That's it.
Until the last moment when that lid closes on us, our lives keep going on in very complex ways, and it's true with the characters and daughters. This doesn't close the book on them, so yeah. We'll have to see what happens next. Triunion, is that based roughly on Barbados?
No, what I did was, and this is the way I usually sort of create these places, I took a number of islands. I love Dominica, and so a lot of Triunion looks like Dominica in my head. Parts of Haiti, parts of the Dominican Republic, small portion of Guadeloupe. And I brought them all together to create this mythical island called Triunion. And I decided to call it Triunion because I wanted to suggest, first of all, what happened during the history of this hemisphere, how the French, the British, and the Spanish, who were the major colonial powers at the time during slavery, in a sense, ruled that little island. And to make the point, again, not being heavy-handed about it, I hope, that one of the things that perhaps has to be done in the West Indies to make it a region that will be sort of listened to in the councils of the world is that there's a need to bring together in a kind of union the French-speaking, the English-speaking, and Spanish-speaking islands to bring about a kind of federation, to just simply suggest that, to talk about the necessity for unity. Also, I was able, through Triunion, the island of Triunion, to suggest the need to bring about a reconciliation and a linkage between African-American, West Indian, and African. Again, the triangle. The triangle is a very important configuration for me. It takes in the Middle Passage, that triangular trade that brought Africans to this part of the world. And so it has a very important meaning in the way I kind of see, in the way I kind of see reality.
Of course, you have roots in Barbados. Do you ever go there? Have you really
yes,
been there?
I do. I do. Yes, I do. I have roots also in the United States. And one of the things I was trying to do in Daughters, in the character of Ursa McKenzie, the protagonist, was to try to capture the sense that the African-American and West Indian aspects of the diaspora really have to, in a sense, come together. And Ursa, in her person, who's very much like myself, someone who's both African-American and West Indian, brings together those two great wings of the black diaspora in the Western Hemisphere. She embodies the two traditions, the two cultures.
It should be noted that Daughters is not a novel for blacks, and it's not a novel for women. It's a novel for everyone.
It certainly is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That it's about, essentially, if you know one wants to say, what is the theme of that novel? The kind of long, difficult struggle, battle that so many of us have to wage in order to really achieve true autonomy, true independence. That certainly is Ursa's struggle in the novel. And I think it's one that anyone can identify with. It's about taking charge of your life. It's about realizing yourself.
Well, it's beautifully done, Paul Marshall, and I appreciate that you had the time to come in and talk to me. I thank you very, very much. By the way, I guess your folks wanted a boy, huh?
No.
Paul?
They wanted a girl, which they got, and they named her Pauline.
Ah.
And I hated it.
So you named yourself.
So I, around 12 or 13, I decided to rename myself.
A whole new identity. Well, that's what Jamaica Kincaid did. She created a new name for herself.
I see.
And a whole new name. She said, I'm starting all over again with a whole new name.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. That's one way to do it.
She's from Antigua. You know, instead of calling herself Jamaica Kincaid, she should have called herself Antigua Anderson or something like that.
Well, I suppose maybe she was trying to do away with Antigua also.
I think so. Daughters, it's a beautiful book, Paul Marshall. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.